Hello and welcome to the Boston Book Festival! You picked the right room to be in. You picked the right books to read. This panel is going to be amazing. All right, we have here Julie Berry of Lovely War. This is all historical young adult. Her book is about World War I. There's the gods, Aphrodite, Ares, Apollo, Hades, Hephaestus, are all having this fight about these two groups of lovers, these two pairs of lovers, and the gods are kind of like intervening in their lives as they're going through all of the trials and tribulations of World War I. It's amazing. It's brilliant. Everybody should read it. You should also read In the Neighborhood of True by Susan Captain Carleton.
So there's
a Jewish New York transplant to 1950s Atlanta. She's navigating the debutante world of balls, Southern culture, and anti-Semitism. She hasn't told anybody, even her boyfriend, that she's Jewish. And they're going to these all-white, all-Christian clubs and things like that. And then when there is a big anti-Semitic hate crime, which I'm not going to go into, she has to make some very difficult decisions. It's an amazing book. It's super powerful. In the Neighborhood of True. And then White Rose by Kip Wilson. This is a novel in verse about World War II and some people who are the resistance against the Nazis spreading information and trying to get the word out and trying to stop the war. And it's a very powerful book. It's all in verse. It's told in a very interesting structure. All these books are amazing. Please give them all a hand. You're going to love these. You have to buy all of them. So I'm James Kennedy. I'm the author of The Order of Oddfish, and I run something called the 92nd Newbery Film Festival, and I'll be doing a thing later on. But it's not about me. It's about them, okay? So first, I want to start out, like, please tell me, like, the genesis of the book and, like, why, how you stumbled upon an idea and why this book right now. Kip, why don't we start with you?
So this is based on a true story, White Rose, and I first heard about the White Rose when I was in high school, in my high school German class. And to me at the time, this was a long time ago because I am old. At that time, I was 14 years old, and I hear about these kids, not much older than me, standing up to something terrible and doing something about it, making a difference. And I was so inspired by them way back then that I just spent years and years and years researching them and finding out more and trying to find the way to write this story, which was not easy. And I actually wrote it originally as nonfiction, and I could not get that to work. And then years after I tried that, actually, there's this wonderful book called We Will Not Be Silent by Russell Freeman. And that book is an excellent young adult nonfiction about the group. And I was like, that's what I was trying to do. I couldn't do that. So, but eventually, I discovered that, oh, actually, this is the way that I could tell the story.
In verse
was the only way for me to make it work.
In the Neighborhood of True?
And so my book is set in 1958 Atlanta. Oh, now suddenly I'm at her. And our family moved to Atlanta in the early 2000s and joined sort of the big reform, progressive synagogue in town because I knew that it had a history of being sort of at the forefront of civil rights. Social justice was sort of baked into who this congregation was. And one day we picked up our younger daughter from Sunday school. She slid in the back seat of the station wagon and she said, did you know that my classroom was blown up 50 years ago, and I did not. And it turns out that this that the rabbi at the time in the 50s who'd been sort of trying to agitate his congregation to get active in civil rights is sort of retribution for that. White supremacists had blown up the congregation early on a Sunday morning. And in my daughter's classroom, she could still see like the shrapnel on the walls. And that just haunted me, that idea that these walls that held kids, you know, had been blown apart. Nobody was killed in the bombing, thankfully. But I just held on to that idea that that you're not really safe in a sanctuary when there's hatred right outside your doors.
Mm-hmm. So Lovely War got its start with me kind of asking the question, why don't we talk about World War I much? Why don't we have very many books about it? And even asking myself, well, how did it start exactly? And maybe we don't talk about it because it's confusing and it's, you know, sort of a murky narrative. World War II is much more recent. So I started thinking about World War I, started researching it. My mom was a teenager during World War II, and so I had been thinking about what's it like to be a kid at home during the war? What's it like to be a young person living through a wartime? What's it like to be a soldier? Because my uncles fought in the war. And so then I sort of transferred those questions to World War I, and I decided that I wanted to research the war and that I wanted to write a love story set during the war. And as I tried to make that work and tried lots of different beginnings, things just weren't clicking. And part of that was because a love story by its nature is a very intimate look at two people, or, you know, in this case, there's two love stories, so four people. But, and so you have to get really, really close, and that's the pleasure of a romance. You want to feel what they're feeling. You want to, you know, hear the flutter of the heartbeat when they see the special someone. But that is a trade-off, right? Because you trade that closeness and intimacy for a broader perspective. And I felt like this war was so big and had such far-reaching implications for, you know, tens of millions of people all around the globe. And I felt like it would be a kind of malpractice to only just have, you know, boy meets girl, war, kiss, you know, and miss the bigger picture. But I didn't want to write a textbook. And so I thought, I need a kind of unconventional perspective. So I thought, what if I had... well, okay, maybe I should explain the premise. Oh, you kind of heard the premise. These Greek gods are telling the story. So Aphrodite and Ares meet up for a romantic rendezvous in a Manhattan hotel, and Aphrodite's jealous husband busts them, catches them in a golden net, and is preparing to drag them to Mount Olympus and humiliate them. But instead, Aphrodite bargains with her husband, and so what follows is a kind of mock trial right there in the court, in the hotel room. And so then Aphrodite, to plead her defense, tells these two love stories set during World War I. So that's the shape. But how that happened is I was trying to figure out how to both get close to my lovers and get broad with what the war did without it being boring. And I thought, well, what if love personified was my storyteller? I thought, well, that could be interesting, except love personified is hardly the voice you would choose for a battle scene. And then I thought, well, maybe I need war personified, too, to tell some stories. And then I went, wait a minute. We already have love personified. We already have war personified, and they're secret lovers. I was like, hot diggity dog. You know? So then from that moment on, the story just took off, and the writing clicked, and it was fun, and I loved it. In fact, for much of the time, I felt like they are never going to let me get away with this. I don't know who they were, but it was like they are never going to let me have, you know, philandering Greek gods in a hotel room telling a World War I love story. Like, somebody's going to shut this down. But it was fun, and so I just went with it, and here we are.
It's that daring thing that sets it apart. Yeah. When I was first reading, I was like, what is she trying to get away with here? And then I really like when the gods enter the scenes, and they kind of, like, Aphrodite, like, acts like a waitress to, like, push the lovers together, or you know, Hades or Apollo, the various gods come on. They take part in the action, and they do things, and they have their own stakes. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting, and you were mentioning it's kind of like The Book Thief, Death itself is a narrator, and it kind of has that feeling, but it kind of takes that idea even further. So your book also has an interesting structure because it's done in verse, and you said only when you did it in verse were you able to kind of really nail the tone. And why do you think verse freed you to do it that way?
Well, I had tried so long to figure it out, and I'd actually set it aside and was working on other novels and things in the meantime. And at the time, I was the poetry editor at YARN, the Young Adult Review Network, and part of my job there was to interview verse novelists. I read all... There's not that many verse novels that come out in a year. There's going to be more, but I would read all of them every year. And so I had two verse novelists, and I interviewed them for the journal. And, you know, I was asking them, so they had both written historicals in verse. I said, so I'm interested, why did you decide to write that in verse? And they're like, well, you know, historical, tragic subjects like this tend to lend themselves really well to verse. And I was like, oh! Kind of like you with the Harrys and Aphrodite. I started working on it the next day, and it just whoosh.
Speaking of structure, in The Neighborhood of True, our main character, she's a transplant from New York. She's coming into this kind of new world, and she kind of like in many books like this, she wears a mask. And then at a certain point, the mask must fall. Like she says she's one thing, she's actually the other. And at first, it's like, how is she going to thread this needle of like, usually you're not very sympathetic with somebody who is not true to who they are. However, you were able to make that work. And how were you able to make that work? Because I love this character. I loved how kind of selfish she was and how she had these very teen-like kind of appetites and desires and wants that were kind of at war with other things about her. Like, and I was just like, how did you thread that needle?
I'm so glad you thought I did.
I agree. Yeah.
I mean, she is selfish, and that's actually one thing I love about her is that she, and she kind of owns that she's selfish. She doesn't pretend to mask it in anything. And as a New Yorker coming to the South and being sort of introduced to the manners of the South, at one point she says, you know, you can't trust a smile. People throw them around like confetti. And so she, in many, many ways, is true to herself, except she happens to not mention that she's Jewish. She just decides to slide that to the side because she wants so much to fall in love with the place and the boy and the dresses and the dances. I don't know how I think I just really wanted her to be real. I mean, I think we are all many things at the same time. That is what makes us, you know, so that she can be selfish and at times selfless, and she can appreciate the beauty and also see the hatred, and she can be in love and wonder if his hands are dirty with a bomb. It all happens like smushed together because that's the way we go through life in that smushy way.
So I noticed an error in your book at one point.
Yes, tell me.
The main character, she has sweet tea for the first time.
Yes.
And she says it's delicious. But sweet tea is not delicious.
Well, I beg to differ.
Okay. You're wrong.
And I will say that many times that she drinks the sweet tea, it is ribboned with something from a flask. So that does change its character.
Advice to all you kids. So let's talk about research. These are all YA historical novels. In a way, there's no such thing as a historical novel. We're always talking about the present and the problems that we're having in the present, the tensions that we're having in the present. Please tell me about your research methods for this, what you discovered along the way, and how it kind of threads into the problems that we're experiencing right now. Go!
Sure. Well, you know, it was so fascinating to me to dive into World War I, because, like I said, I hadn't really spent any time thinking about it since high school history class. And so, you know, as I dove in and read about, first of all, I just wanted to be able to explain to a stranger, like, how did World War I start? I feel like if I can't give you that answer, then I don't know my subject. So I'm trying to figure out how did this war start, and I'm reading about the breakdown of diplomacy around the world and how countries stopped, you know, having their best people talk to one another to head off, stave off conflicts. And then I looked at the news. And then and I read about the rise of nationalist sentiment among certain countries and a sort of us first, everyone else second mentality. And then I looked at the news. And then I read about, you know, the role of specific egocentric personalities, certain leaders, certain, for example, oh gosh, now of course all like the names are gonna completely. Kaiser Wilhelm, right, was the you know, he was a member of the great tribe of European leaders that descended from Queen Victoria, but he was kind of like the overlooked one. He was the annoying one that nobody could stand. He was like shorter than everyone else, and he had some like chips on his shoulder against his cousins who were always handsomer and cooler and wouldn't invite him to sit at the kids' table at the family party.
Like, I want to read the YA Kaiser Wilhelm.
for real, yeah. Honestly. Mm-hmm. And so doesn't he grow up and like declare war on his cousin who was the Tsar of Russia? And doesn't he grow up and, you know, like in Britain.
But your book is about none of this.
Oh, I know. I wanted it to be about all of it, right? Like there was so much, like, you know, your research and you just like gorge yourself on all these delicious, interesting facts, and then your editor's like, nope. Well, and so you realize you have to focus, you have to narrow in, you have to choose your story, you have to discipline yourself to throw out, and this thing's still a brick. I mean, there's so much I put in, so much more that I had to take out.
Well, can I guide you a little bit?
Sure,
You talk about there's a regiment of black soldiers who are brought over, and they're a band, but they're also fighting and they're doing work. And there's this real life people like James Reese Europe, who is like this. I never heard of this guy. This guy is amazing. Could you tell about like how you came, who James Reese Europe is, and how you came upon him, and how he's kind of in the book?
Sure. So I mentioned there are two love stories. There's four young lovers. Two are British. One's a Belgian refugee, and one is an American soldier, a member of the Harlem Hellfighters division that fought in World War I, one of several all-black divisions in the segregated U.S. Army. And these divisions were incredible for so many reasons, for their valor on the battlefield, their incredible discipline, the hostility and lynching and violence that they faced from other American servicemen who were threatened by the idea of black soldiers. But also, in addition to all that, most all divisions had an army band, but these black divisions had a ragtime army band, which was like the hot new music breaking on the scene. And so they were musical visionaries. And when the war broke out, conditions in the South, right? Like there's still slavery being practiced. It's called convict leasing and chain gangs. But make no mistake, slavery is still going on in full force from the end of the Civil War right to the start of World War II. So we're living in this climate of lynching, segregation, hostility, racism, white supremacists present in the White House. And the war breaks out, and a lot of African Americans say, here's our chance. You know, our state and local governments have betrayed us, but the federal government might be our friend, and so we'll enlist, and we'll demonstrate our commitment to America, and our integrity, and our courage, and we'll come home, and we'll earn respect, and the full rights of citizenship in this country. And so you have, these heroes, and among them was James Reese Europe, who was a composer and musician, originally from the South, who moved to New York, and he had started all these ragtime bands throughout New York City. He had pioneered what was called at the time the first concert of Negro music at Carnegie Hall. So he was a visionary composer, brilliant ragtime musician, and he survived the war. He wrote fantastic hits during the war. He really set France on fire with a love of ragtime. I'm sorry, like you got an elbow. but he then was murdered a few months after the war's end by one of his own musicians, who was clearly suffering from shell shock and psychological trauma, and just in a moment of anger stabbed him. And so it was a tragic, tragic loss. But I'm certain that if that had not happened, the names that you're familiar with, Dizzy Gillespie and all the jazz greats whose names you would also know his name if he'd had the chance to live just a little bit longer. And what he did for African American music and for the war effort, it's a story that needs to be told. So if this can open a few eyes to that, I'm thrilled.
Susan, are there any real life people that kind of show up in one way or another in your book, or maybe in a kind of a disguised, fictionalized form?
Yeah, I had made a decision because the seed of the novel was this true event. I early on decided to completely fictionalize it. So I was inspired by people who were really important, including the newspaper publisher Ralph McGill, a Southerner who wrote these like passionate editorials for early civil rights stuff, and the column he wrote after the day after this temple was bombed, won the Pulitzer that year. And so I made the grandfather character a newspaper guy as sort of a nod to my historical crush on Ralph McGill. But I think that's an interesting thing about writing a historical novel, is at some point you need to make that choice. And of course, yours is a real person, so you have the fidelity to that story. But I had the freedom to, wander.
Well, tell me about your research, Kip, and how balancing between, you have a real life person here, how much can you fictionalize and how much do you have to maintain strict fidelity to fact and still have a story that's gripping, which it is.
Yeah.
Thank you. I initially tried to just keep as 100% with the facts, and as much as I could, I kept everything in there and didn't add things that were not, I couldn't verify. But little by little, I added a little bit, and mostly on the side of Sophie's thoughts and feelings that nobody would really, even if she were still alive now, she probably couldn't tell us, well, in this moment, I was really feeling whatever, but to just bring it more to life and make it more engaging. And I was thinking all the time, thinking myself as a 14-year-old, hearing about this group and what would I want to hear and what would I want to know? And I'd want to know what were you feeling at that moment? What was it like to bring these leaflets to the university when you knew you could get caught at any moment, when you knew that if you got caught, you would likely not survive.
And that was the act of resistance that got them in trouble, like
exactly.
Distributing leaflets.
Mm-hmm.
With, yeah.
And these leaflets. So they said things at the time. I was thinking when Julie was talking about the parallels to, you know, today's news and so on. One of the lines in the leaflets is, every word that comes out of Hitler's mouth is a lie. Mm. And that right there is 100% treason at the time that would get you executed just for if holding that paper, let alone writing and distributing those papers.
Did he say he liked sweet tea?
he might really get over it for that.
The kind of person that would have liked it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't trust these people. So in your book, the love interest is this guy, Davis Jefferson.
Yes.
At first...
A tribute name, yes.
At first, he seems to be kind of like... He seems to have an ironic distance to the racism and anti-Semitism around him. That's kind of why the main character is able to fall in love with him. Like, he kind of takes all this, like, Southern supremacy stuff, it seems, as a joke. But, and so we kind of get charmed by him, too, because we're like, oh, well, maybe this is somebody that, you know, like, we can sympathize with. But over time, we kind of, like, realize this guy's a bit of a coward, and he's not all that he... how do we make somebody fall in love with somebody that we're eventually going to have to, in our minds, disown? Like a love story, you're kind of like managing all these different, sentiments towards the characters. And I just thought you, again, threaded that needle really well. And tell us about the making of this character, Davis Jefferson.
I was doing a book group a few weeks ago, and someone said, "Really, Davis Jefferson?" I said, "Yes, really." Like. I'd ordered various yearbooks and as part of my research. eBay is wonderful. Various yearbooks from 1958, Atlanta private schools. And every single one, there was Davis Jefferson.
Wow.
So
there's a lot of families where their last name was Jefferson. And they're like, I have an idea.
I know. Here we go. Yeah. So I think many of us have had a relationship like that where you fall in love.
Yeah. Did you draw on a real life relationship for that?
Sort of, yeah, okay. I did sort of. But I was more interested in this idea that we can fall, especially I think as teenagers, although as adults too, we can fall so in love with a person or a place or, Ruth also falls for Atlanta, falls in love with Atlanta and its loveliness, and falls in love with a boy. She falls so far in love that she sort of loses, she forgets who she is.
Mm.
And when I finished the book, all the time I was writing it, I wasn't thinking that I had anything of particular of my own to add to it. But then I remembered that my college boyfriend, who I completely loved and who was a great guy, the first time I met I was getting ready to meet his grandfather for the first time, and he said, you know, he's really tough, and I really, really want him to like you, so just don't mention that you're Jewish.
Ah.
Just don't mention it. I thought, like,
this is the real genesis of the book.
Yeah, so it took me, I guess I'm slow, it took me a long time to figure out that, oh, that's where that came from.
Hmm. Wow.
But isn't that, like, the problem we face, right, in all historical fiction, is that anachronism of the values that we hold today for whether or not we can like somebody based on their, you know, their views. Do they have acceptable views about inclusiveness and diversity? And, you know, are they a chauvinist? Are they a racist? Are they a homophobe? And the fact is, if we're going to write about actual people who lived 60, 70, 80, 100, you know, 300 years ago, they're going to have a whole bag of views that we find repugnant.
Yeah.
And so we have to really kind of figure out how to walk that line. Because I think one thing that would be a great mistake is to say that the lives of those who went before us aren't worth our consideration because of some of their repugnant values or their values which were were commonplace and normal then, which we don't share today. At the same time, I certainly don't want to sanitize or normalize or condone or endorse those values. So it's something I really struggle with. Mm-hmm. And I think when we're writing about the past, how to handle that with sensitivity and care and respect is a real issue. And I don't want to just imagine a wonderland of the past where everybody had today's progressive values. And, you know, maybe someday they'll be writing about us and having to have these same wranglings.
Uh-huh.
You know,
I think we do still, though, today, you know, have those same, like we all have that Uncle Bob. Who
exactly. I was just.
Well, yeah. Let's be real. We have ourselves.
Right.
We have to look at how our own views have hopefully evolved and where they may still need attention.
Evolution.
No, I nailed it. So, speaking of, what have you taken? What authors have you taken as inspirations for your own stuff? Mm. What have you seen and also what have you read this year that you feel has like really kind of, you know, I think you in particular wanted to talk about this.
I have so many things I want to say.
Sam.
Well, yeah. First I want to answer the part about the books this year.
Oh, okay.
Because I've been recommending this whole year ever since I've been out with this book, a book that came out this year called Internment by Samira Ahmed. Some of you, I see some nods, have read this book. It is an amazing story. It's a dystopian. I hope it will never become reality, but it's about a Muslim internment camp and a teenage girl and her family that are sent there and how they resist. It's got a girl with a cap that says resist on the cover. And this girl actually takes the White Rose as her inspiration, and she starts sending out messages to the press, just like they had the leaflets. I was reading the book because I wanted to read the book anyway when it came out, and I was like, oh, look, she's talking about the White Rose, and I was amazed to see that. But anyway, this book is I highly recommend it to everyone because it's so relevant today, and I hope it stays a dystopian.
Before we pop over to you guys, why were they called the White Rose, this resistance group?
Okay, so this is one of the questions that I wish I had Hans and Sophie around with me today, because that's one of the questions I would just love to ask. And there are so many things that, little details, like why did you call your group the White Rose? And that they called it that themselves. A lot of resistance groups became known as the whatever, but they actually, that this is the leaflet of the White Rose. But we don't really know. Like Hans said in his interrogations that, oh, I was reading a novel of that name at the time. But, you know, we're not really sure. And they're known as a symbol of purity, the White Rose. There are lots of reasons it could be. But, again, in the end, we just don't know. And I wish I could sit down with them.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So things that inspire you and things that you've read this year that you're really into.
Something I just read that I really loved is called I'm Not Dying With You Tonight. Mm. It's told from two points of view. It takes place over a single night. And I tend to love, you know, stories that have that inherent ticking clock. And it takes place in Atlanta, and there's a black character and a new white girl in town, and after a football game, riots break out, and they have to sort of navigate the night together as
and
strangers.
And it's two authors, right?
And it's two authors. Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, really well done and an adrenaline rush. The other question, influence? Oh, that's a totally different answer. Mm-hmm. So, and I wouldn't say influence sounds like too fancy a word, but I did, like, reread Great Gatsby, and particularly, you know, when I read that book initially, I remember thinking about it as sort of a commentary on the American dream. But when I read it with this book in mind, I was really tuned into all the ways that deception and first love are so compelling. So I think I had that sort of in mind. And there's this great Fitzgerald quote. It's from The Side of Paradise, not Gatsby, where he says something like, they fell quickly into a love from which they'd never recover. Mm. And I felt like I wanted that sense in there. Mm-hmm.
That's cool. So I'm in research mode right now and have been for most of this year, so pretty much everything I'm reading is, you know, nonfiction, historical stuff. But I've just read, Slavery by Another Name by Douglas Blackman, which was a Pulitzer Prize winning title, oh, I forget, like 2008 or 9 or something it came out, and just gripping, mesmerizing, heartbreaking, you know, mythology shattering book that I feel like every American should read. So that has been, that's really owned me lately. As far as inspiration, I think I'm always, I mentioned The Book Thief. I'm really drawn to books that have a way of invoking the spiritual, and by that I mean, like, our deepest questions about our loves, our values, and the purpose of life in the context of death. You know, what does life really mean, given that it's not going to last forever? And what do we do with that? So I think one book that really moved me deeply, and I read it a long, long time ago, but it was Peace Like a River by Leif Anger. And I got to meet him last week, which was so cool. And I was kind of nervous because I hate it when you love a book with all your heart and soul, and then you meet the author, and they're kind of a narcissist, and you're like, oh, you know, now I don't believe in anything anymore. You know, so I almost didn't want to meet him because if he disappointed me, then, like, what was it all for? But he was, like, every bit as sweet and thoughtful and kind and genuine as I would imagine the writer of that book to be. And so all's well. But you should read pieces.
Questions. Does anybody have any questions? All right. I'm going to bring the mic over to you. Is this mic on? Cool.
Hello, hello. Thank you all so much for coming. I'm particularly thrilled at an all-woman panel. That's awesome. Us, of course. What would we do without
you? I can take the hit.
My question is for Kip. Because you mentioned that when you started writing in verse, things started to click in place. I was wondering, kind of despite that type of seamlessness that came with switching to that form, what was the most challenging thing about writing in verse, and how did you overcome that problem?
That's a great question. Do you also write poetry? You do. Awesome. So I think with poetry, you have every word counts so much. It's like almost like writing when you write a picture book or something. You have to be very, very careful with your word choices. And for me, I learned very quickly, because I had to when I started writing this, that, like, well, you know, I have all these, like, wonderful things I researched that I want to fit in here, but I'm not going to be able to. And so I had to be able to say more with less words, right, with fewer words. So I, for instance, had a lot of letters that Sophie had written with her from her boyfriend that were from him to her or from her to him. And, you know, I would take this full letter, which was like maybe several pages long, and would just pick out the most important parts and then versify them. And that would be like the core idea was enough, and that was what mattered. Just like not trying. You don't have to say everything.
But was some of the verse kind of collage? They were just kind of like paring down and remixing.
A little bit with the letters, especially because. This is a good point for me to quick read a letter.
Go for it.
Here's an example, because this also it goes with a lot of what we were talking about before about, you know, people, how people thought back then and so on. So, a letter to Fritz from Sophie, okay? Dear Fritz. Now I'm going to completely forget it. I know. Yeah. Thank you for asking me what I think about the German folk. A soldier's oath to his folk, to his Führer, is like the unconditional love of a son to his family. If the father harms someone, then the son must back him up. But he shouldn't. Mm. Justice is more important than family, than Volk, than Führer. Justice is more important than anything. And so that sentiment was from a real letter that she wrote, but she didn't write it in verse.
It reminds me of that G.K. Chesterton quote, my country, right or wrong, is like saying my mother, drunk or sober. You ever heard that one?
I haven't, but
it's a goodie. Yeah. Does anybody have any other questions? Yeah. Doop.
So you've touched on this a little bit, but one of the real challenges writing anything about history is that there are things we don't know about the past, mm-hmm. and our interpretations of what happened have changed dramatically over time. And continue to change all of the time, And so I'm really interested in how you as authors engage with that, how you fill in gaps in ways that feel authentic to both the story and the truth of the past. And also, what do you do when there really are arguments about what happened? I know, so The Passion of Dulce, mm-hmm. which your previous book, which is one of the best young adult novels I have read in my life.
I agree, yes.
really does that, and it really is really getting into arguments about what did these heretics believe, and, mm-hmm. you know, are our sort of traditional ideas about them wrong in ways that have changed like really rapidly even in the past. And I think what you were talking about with we don't know why the White Rose did this or that, but it might be very important in the novel to know. So mm-hmm. I'm curious how all of you address those things.
Oh, that's a great question.
Good. So we want to start with Susan for this one. And,
sure.
And in fairness to me, I don't think you've read my YA book, so I'm going to let you go on that.
Not yet. So I think because what I was striving for, because I made this decision to make it a completely fictional work, I was striving for sort of an emotional truth as opposed to a historical truth. And because my book takes place in 1958, so there were a number of people still with us who remember it well, including the wife of the rabbi at the time, who has a crystal clear memory of what that event was like. But of course, that's just her perspective on it. You know, she's seeing it through that lens as a member of the clergy. So I think you raise a great point, and I think the best we can do is tell it as fully as we can. And 10 years from now, someone might take that same, you know, early civil rights Atlanta jumping off point and have a completely different take on it. So I just try to stay in my lane and tell as full and rich and sort of emotionally true story as I could. I don't know if that answers your question, but I hope so. Mm-hmm.
Julie, you want to take it?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. Thank you. But.
But also. I mean
is it for sale out there?
It is.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I've learned through the process of writing The Passion of Dulce that whenever we research any aspect of history, especially to represent it to the world in some form, whether you're writing a news article or a novel or whatever, that we have a real responsibility to say, is this true, and how do we know that it's true, and has it been peer verified? Has this reached consensus within its academic community? And if not, what are the voices of dissent on that? You know, is this a hostile perspective on some aspect of the past? And what does the actual historical, archaeological, et cetera, record have to offer us? And at the same time, as much as I like kind of strive to, you know, approach that asymptote of truth, I have to acknowledge that I will not be able to. I mean, I don't have the tools because I'm not a professional historian. I just play one on TV, you know. but even professional historians don't have all the answers. And as you say, the past is as much, if not more, what sense and interpretation we make of what happened as it is what objectively happened. I mean, as we all know, right, even when there's a video of an event, it can turn out that our understanding of what we're seeing in that video is wrong. Which is not to say that, you know, because all truth or data or documentation is potentially suspect doesn't mean we discount it, but we look for verification, we look for multiple sources. So writing about history, it does confront you with this question of history and the practice of documenting it as a moral act, and what's true, and are we being conscientious about that? So I'm just blathering on, but you've like opened the door to my my heart there, so thank you.
Yep.
One quick thing. I was in in Atlanta a few weeks ago for the Decatur Book Festival, a big, like the Boston Book Festival. But
humble
not.
Brag. Okay.
And no. But there was, and Decatur's kind of a progressive suburb of Atlanta. And in front of the city hall, there's a Civil War monument, very prominent. And for a long time, there's been conversation about what to do with this monument. And while we were there, they erected like a fancy monument-y contextual explanation of why it was there. And so I thought that was interesting, that it was, they couldn't get rid of it for whatever bureaucratic reasons, and so they sort of looked at it through a different lens. So I think I like that idea of history always sort of being fluid in a way.
Yeah, and 'twas ever thus. I mean, a lot of those monuments got put up in the early 1900s for explicit reasons. So they were always, there's no pure perspective on the past. We're always looking at it, recontextualizing it from where we are. Kip?
So I can give a specific example because I thought about this a lot because, I originally tried to stay as close to the facts as I could.
And you were looking at original documents in German.
That's right. And I think that also really helped me be able to write this book because I don't know. I mean, there are so many sources that you wouldn't be able to read if you didn't speak German. So that was very important to me. One thing, though, that I could not find in any of the documentation of Sophie's, any of her letters or any of her diaries, was anything about her feelings about the Holocaust, which was, you know, wasn't called that at the time. It was going on. It was the genocide that was going on. And
the genocide of the week. Oh my gosh! Like, what world do we live in? Like, it was the genocide that was going on at that
at then, that time. Yeah. I know.
Not
I
to mean, be confused with
no.
any of yeah. the subsequent.
Maybe.
Oh my gosh.
But you know, I had to add in some of this background because it was going on, and they did know about it. And their leaflets. They were speaking out against it. They were saying, "This stuff is going on. People, wake up. Do something about it." Right, but. So I said, well, you know, if I'm Sophie, and it's 1940, and I'm wandering through Ulm, what do I see? And so I looked at the Holocaust Museum's website. They had some really helpful photographs. And so I have this poem called Ripples. And that poem has three examples of signs that she would have seen in Ulm. One was on the bridge going into town to Ulm that said, Juden in Ulm nicht erwünscht. So Jews not wanted in Ulm, right there as you came into town. Another one on the park benches, nur für Arier, only for Aryans. And on the Jewish storefronts, kein Deutscher kauft hier, no German would shop here. I don't know specifically what she thought about that, but we know she had Jewish friends. She and her family spoke out against the Holocaust, so obviously she would have been appalled by this. So that's what I worked into the poem. But again, that part is a bit fiction because I don't know exactly.
But you put the word for word, you put those things.
I did.
Well,
yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Other questions?
With a historical novel where we don't know too much about it, we need a lot of description. How do you balance the character and the character's story with identifying everything that's going on? Just like you were saying, all those signs on the benches, how do you make sure that we understand there are signs everywhere without just getting the reader bogged down in all of this description?
Yeah, the past is like an alien world sometimes. It's like a science fiction novel. It can be so different.
Right. Will somebody else want to go first?
No, go ahead.
Okay, well, let me think. So for me, it was really about like images like that, like taking a specific, you know, there's no way I could cover everything. But, you know, also this is a bit strange for a YA novel too, although Julie's, yours is also spans years, but which is usually YA is like about a year is how long the span of a novel is, or less. You know, sometimes it's a day. And mine goes from, you know, basically like 1934 to 1943. And in that time, all kinds of different things happen. There's no way I could cover all of that. So I was picking and choosing things that would have come from her own experience, or that I think, like with the bridge sign, that, you know, she would have seen that, right? Or, you know, when the Battle of Stalingrad happened and what was her reaction to this. So just picking specific things. And of course, with verse, it's already, like I said, very sparse. You have to choose your words wisely. So, what about you guys?
I think, yeah, a similar thing. It's a pick and choose kind of thing. I have a friend who writes adult novels, Marjan Kamali, and she says, details are like spice, too much, and it tastes like mud. And so I thought that was good advice, because I tend to want to sort of shoehorn shoehorn in every bit of crinoline or in her dress or whatever.
Oh, the fashions in this book are great. Mm-hmm. The way that you describe all the outfits, you put a lot of detail in that.
Yeah, I really like that bit. but I ordered all these fashion magazines, and I got, you know, from the 50s, and I got sucked down like a Mademoiselle rabbit hole, and I did really want to add that in, and then I ended up taking some of it out because of this idea that too much spice just muddies the stew. So I think it's that trying to be mindful of choice.
Thank you for that question. That's like you described my pain in that.
Exactly.
But so I have a job that I want to do, which is talk about a time and a place, characters that interest me. But I also know that I know what you've hired me to do, which is entertain you. And I don't disparage that. I think entertainment is like a high and holy thing. So my job is to bring you into the place that I want to be and make you want to be there too. And so I have to figure out how to make that place understandable. And I keep gravitating toward lesser known periods of history. So I can't, like you all know what a Nazi is, doesn't need to be explained, but you don't know, you know, what a 13th century inquisitor is, or, you know, like there's a lot that, like in World War I, there was a lot that I didn't know, so I don't assume most readers do. So my job is to find a way to make that as real and believable and understandable as I can. And oftentimes, you won't understand a dilemma unless you understand the context that creates that dilemma. So I've got to make sure I don't write a textbook by mistake. So I have to. That's a struggle. But I also think, I believe every creative project has an inherent challenge or flaw. Like, the thing that will sabotage this project is this. Like, if you don't know the context and history, the whole thing falls apart. But I also think that the inherent flaw or pitfall in a project is its opportunity to shine and to be excellent and to be impactful. So I really try hard to find that balance between fact and exposition and detail and story and emotion and pace. And so I guess all I can say is you have to be aware of that, you have to do your best, and you have to do an awful lot of cutting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's our time. So everybody, Kip Wilson! Susan Kaplan Carlton! And Julie Berry. I'm James Kennedy. At 2:30, I'm doing a 92nd Newbery Film Festival workshop in the Ray Room. We're all going to be out there signing books now. Go and sin no more.